You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Sip on the go with a Starbucks Iced Shaken Espresso. Our signature roast, shaken with ice, then finished with a splash of milk. Customize it to match your style on the Starbucks app. Make today a good day.
Top tech companies like Intel have a secret to their success. They get the best talent, reliable infrastructure, and save on costs by expanding in Ohio, the new Silicon Heartland. Learn how your business can succeed in Ohio. Visit successinohio.com.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the podcast about how and why popular music happens with host Nate Wilcox. Be sure and subscribe to the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Podomatic, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. You can now follow us on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and we'd love to hear what you think, so don't be shy about tweeting at us or commenting on our website. This week, Robert Christgau, the Dean of American Rock Critics, joins Nate to discuss his books, Is It Still Good to Ya?, and Book Reports. In this episode, Robert and Nate discuss the role of criticism in popular music, the concept of semi-popular music, YouTube versus Spotify, blackface minstrelsy, and more. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. Today, I've got the honor of being joined by the Dean of American Rock Critics, Robert Christgau. The books are Is It Still Good to Ya? And Book Reports. Robert, welcome.
Hiya. Glad to do it.
Cool. And so, you know, rock criticism is a unique thing. And I want to talk about the books, but I also want to have a meta conversation about the role of the rock critic in the business of music. And so,
well, it's been a long time now, and it's evolved. But go ahead.
Absolutely. And you're the one person basically who's been doing it since the beginning, 1967.
Greil is almost as early, and he does it in a very different way. He's not as comprehensive as I am.
Yeah, absolutely. He does more big think pieces, and you have been in the trenches keeping up with the latest music. You know, I'm 20-something years younger than you and fell way behind. So it's a role that, as a young, callow youth, I had a lot of disrespect for. But the way you've done it, I've come to respect and admire, simply because, in a way, the way you taught yourself to listen as a critic is pretty prescient for the environment everybody's finding themselves in now, where we're all inundated with music. And what I'm referring to is your struggle early on with what Lil Wayne calls out, you know, if you're listening to music for pleasure and you're paying for it, you've got a different sort of critical acuity than if you're inundated with music, you're being paid to try to analyze in the flood. So I've been fascinated with that. Talk a little bit about that and how you taught yourself to deal with that inundation of tunes.
Well, you know, I have to say, there wasn't a lot of self-education involved. The first consumer guide appeared in The Voice just about 50 years ago today. More or less. It was sometime in the month of July, 69. But that related, that followed from what I was already doing. So I lived with a rock critic named Ellen Willis, who by that time was the first rock critic at the New Yorker. But Ellen didn't like to listen the way I listened. For starters, I got all these free LPs in the mail, and to be honest with you, I felt an ethical obligation to hear them all. And what them all meant in those days was what, I mean, does anybody have any notion of how small the fraction is compared to what's available to now when you count SoundCloud and YouTube and all of that stuff, which is completely impossible to track? In this case, there were 6 or 8 or 10 major labels, and they sent me all their LPs, and I thought I should hear them all. And so I went to another apartment. We lived together on East 8th Street. I had the old apartment I lived in, but which I'd maintained. Total rent for these two apartments was $112 a month for 7 rooms, 4 in hers, 3 in mine. And I went, actually 102.
incredible.
And I would go and I would sit in the kitchen, which also had the table, which was my desk, in the 9th Street apartment, with a portable record player, a changer, on a table, or maybe on top of the refrigerator, as I recall. I can't remember, something like that. And I would stack 6 LPs on it and see what stuck. Part of that was my theory, is that the way you got to like music on the radio, which at that time was still a question. FM radio, so-called progressive radio, had hardly begun at that time. You heard a lot of things. You put on WMCA, that was my station, or WABC. Those are the two big AM stations in New York. And you had it on all the time. I always did. In the car, when I was driving around Essex County as a reporter in Jersey. But when I wrote, I never turned the fucking radio off. And some things would stick and others wouldn't. And the idea was to find out, if I started doing this with these LPs, what happened.
And you've been documenting it, you know, for over 50 years now, and created this body of work. It's 8 books and counting, correct?
Is it 8?
Yeah, something like that. I'm pretty sure.
It is 8. It's 8, including the memoir. Yeah.
Yeah, and with the website as a valuable supplement to that. And so it's a really useful tool in this day and age when you can hear almost anything, you know. I kind of get personally offended if I hear of some artist from 60, 70, 80 years ago, and I'm not able to track down a particular song in 5 minutes with the internet. And
yeah, I was just doing that today. There's this writer named Bob Stanley. He's in the Saint HN, and he's also a critic who does a lot of compilations for Ace and people over in Great Britain. And in his book, he lists all these rockabilly songs that he loves that I'd never heard of. And I tried to find them on Spotify just today, and I only found about half of them. Universal, yep. jukebox, my foot.
Well, you know, you have to.
Nothing's universal.
It's true. It's true. And Spotify is very limited. It takes a little extra effort to track down everything. And with the move to streaming away from MP3s, it's actually gotten a little harder in the last couple of years. And I predict it's going to get harder still. And not to get too off topic, but then
apparently, I mean, I don't go to YouTube. A lot of people go to YouTube, which some people seem to feel is even a better source than Spotify.
It is.
I doubt it myself.
It absolutely is. It's a much better source than Spotify. Sometimes it can be hard to tell what version you're hearing, but
sometimes it's not so easy on Spotify either.
No, it's very difficult. Yeah, like why does this Herman song have a Lynn drum on it? Is the kind of thing that drives a dork like me insane. But YouTube is actually better, but not to get too far afield. I want to talk about the two books. You've got two books that basically came out around the same time. You've got Is It Still Good to You, which is another collection of rock criticism, I guess probably the fourth or fifth, and then your first collection of book reviews. What was the difference? And I've noticed that there are several book reviews actually that you snuck into Is It Still Good to You. And so what was the difference when you compiled those? Frame of mind difference in that?
As I say at great length and with untoward enthusiasm in the introduction to both of these books, I've loved journalism collections since 63 or 64. I was somebody who wanted to be a novelist, discovered the journalism collection, and that was one of the things that convinced me I wanted to be a journalist instead. So Pauline Kael, A.J. Liebling, those are two real but lodestones in my literary development. And I am, you know, I am a writer. I care about writing. If you told me when I was in college, chafing in my honors English program, that I would end up being a critic instead of a novelist, I would have said fie on you. But that's the way it worked out. I was better at criticism than I was at fiction. But I still wanted to write as well as I could. And moreover, I wanted to write journalism that withstood, that would still hold up as writing 20 years or 30 years later, or 50, now we're up to. And as far as I'm concerned, I have. And so essentially, when I decided to quit my job at NYU, I immediately began thinking about collections, which had been on my mind, but which I didn't have time to work on. Because of my website, which would not exist were it not for the Herculean efforts of my friend Tom Hull, who input a lot of that stuff by hand, and then organized fans who input more of it. I mean, some of it was in the computer and just was converted, but a lot of that stuff is pre-computer. And a lot of typing on the part of both Tom, one of the fastest and most accurate typists I've ever met in my life, and a bunch of friends, some of whom I've met and some of whom I don't even know who they are, fans. So all of that stuff is, some of that stuff was converted from digital sources. Others was input. And I just looked through everything and said, well, what do I remember that's really good? And I spent a long time organizing it. At first I thought there'd just be one collection, but when I began to see how much there was, and I'd always thought that, as a critic, I do write about books, and I write about writing, and I like being able to do that. I like having that authority. And so I just figured out a way to divide it into two different books. And to my surprise, really, because collections are not easy to sell, even when you're getting paid as little as a university press is going to pay, because they still have to put in the investment of the publication itself. Ken Wissaker, my editor at Duke University Press, and one of the people in the university publishing who really understands popular music and popular music writing. There aren't that many, but there's a few. Lindsay Waters at Harvard was another, who did my Harvard book in 98. He said, yeah, okay, let's do two books. And as I've told my people at my launches, I think I'm probably the only person ever to publish two collections of journalism in the space of a single year, ever. Well,
it could well be true. And as you know, I've spent the last month kind of reading both of them and going back and reading your oeuvre. So it really has this feeling like you've been in my head for, you know, 6 weeks now. And it's sort of hard for me to pull the two books apart. But I ultimately, the difference is the book report, you go beyond music. And for this show, I'm gonna focus on the music book reviews you did there, but the book reports is a much broader look. And especially you look into bohemianism as one of the themes of that.
Always been one of my themes, which I began talking about with Ellen Willis, who I've already mentioned, almost as soon as we were together in 1966, because the hippie thing was just beginning to gather critical mass at that time, and it was happening in our neighborhood, the Lower East Side, as well as San Francisco when we visited there. So I've been thinking about Bohemia, and she had before, for all of that time. Whereas she sort of got me started, and then ultimately, after we split up, she mostly devoted herself to feminism. I was very interested, and I've been reading freelance about the history of Bohemia ever since that time, beginning with Malcolm Cowley's Exile's Return, a book I always tell people to read. That was Ellen's book. And I don't actually think, if there's somebody else who has the knowledge of the literature that I have, I don't know who it is, and I've read the literature. I've read many more books than the ones that I write about in here. And I've given it an enormous amount of thought because my personal life, I still live in the East Village. I live in what was then a bohemian neighborhood, and as happens with bohemian neighborhoods, is gentrified, but it still has that bohemian remnant. But never fully identified with Bohemia. And furthermore, I married a woman who grew up in Greenwich Village. So it's been a very important part of my life. And I feel that in book reports, that section, that's the one thing that, I mean, I write about politics too. And as far as I'm concerned, I do it very well, but lots of people write about politics. Not that many people write about Bohemia. And moreover, I believe that almost anybody who's going to read me has some kind of a connection to Bohemia. Not everybody, but we're talking 90%, I think. Because when young people interested in the arts pass through something like Bohemia in their early 20s, even if they quickly go somewhere else.
Absolutely. And that sort of cues up the first musical piece I want to play, which is the New York Dolls' Jet Boy. And that was the New York Dolls' Jet Boy. And I picked that because that's a group that you've been championing for a long time. And it also fulfills a concept that I think ties into the bohemianism, which is what you call semi-popular music, which the New York Dolls are, to me, like almost a perfect example of. They never sold millions of units, yet they did have a pretty outsized social and musical impact.
Right. I don't think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is still passed them by, isn't it?
I believe so, yeah.
But yes, this is a group that is genuinely beloved by a substantial critical mass kind of audience. Tends to be smart. They tend to talk to each other. I believe, insofar as historical permanence has any meaning at all, they're not going to be forgotten. Any more than, I mean, you know, I think they'll be remembered as long as, let us say, the Buffalo Springfield, a much more successful band who are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and produced Neil Young and other people. I believe in terms of their artistic life, it'll more or less equal. Buffalo Springfield didn't actually put out that many good, great records, you know, so.
Yeah, the
go ahead.
Discography is pretty even between those two, but I want to talk a little bit more about that concept of the semi-popular artist, which, to my knowledge, you coined. And you know, music criticism in the past had sort of focused on high culture, which, without a lot of worry about what was popular and what wasn't, although, you know, the 19th century opera was...
Well, the semi-popular is a word that came to me at a party after I'd had half a joint with somebody who wanted to know what it was I did and what I was interested in. I'm not much of a head at all, but I don't have any doubt really that the loosening that happens under those circumstances helped that word pop into my head. And as soon as it popped out of my mouth, but I, you know, at the moment I thought of it, and I've never forgotten it. And basically it's music that formally aspires to the values and pleasures of genuinely popular pop music without ever becoming massively popular itself, except when it does, which does happen. The Dolls are aren't as good an example as another quintessential semi-popular band, the Ramones, who, to everyone's astonishment, including perhaps theirs, ended up having a career that lasted more than 20 years and having imagined this non-existent audience of people all over America who would identify with their black leather jackets and fast, snappy songs, which seemed really silly. They were on the Lower East Side. They were playing a CBGB. That's what they did. Well, in fact, they then toured for 20 years playing to audiences all over America that fit that description exactly.
Yeah, and packed stadiums in Brazil, and if you go to see a baseball game basically anywhere in America today, you've got a good chance of
hey-ho, let's go. That's right.
Yeah, and you know, so to me that concept of semi-popular artists is sort of a carryover, because you started in Esquire, and which had a sort of middle-brow, high-brow pretensions of covering music before.
Yeah, well, they were paying. That was Esquire is kind of, for me, was the ideal, not the New Yorker Esquire. It's where Tom Wolfe and Norman Mailer worked, and those were people I really liked and cared about. Was a little more irreverent than the New Yorker was, especially back then. I wrote a piece of reportage for Clay Felker's New York Magazine. Clay Felker, I won't go into that, but he was had an Esquire connection. It was a very, very successful piece called Beth Ann and Macrobioticism. It got me book offers, all kinds of stuff, much of which didn't happen, but Esquire called me up and asked me if I wanted to work there, and for a couple of years I did, until the Jazzbo editor figured I really was not going to give up on this rock and roll stuff. He had heard in 68, which was the first of the rock is dead years, that rock was dying, and he asked me to write a piece about why rock was dying, and I wrote a piece about why rock wasn't dying, and he fired me.
And straightforward enough, but you at that point you're creating a niche, because people have been criticizing concert music, classical music, in a serious way for a long time. By that point they'd been criticizing jazz and to some extent folk music in a serious way for a couple of decades, and you're one of the first to criticize pop and rock music in a serious way, and obviously they didn't quite accept it. But then you move on to the Village Voice and have a weekly platform to basically just review records.
Well, and write about whatever else I wanted. The Village Voice was a wonderful place to work. Once I established myself there, especially as an editor, which started in 74, and because in fact their pop music coverage was not very good. It's not as good as it should have been. I could see that there was this enormous opportunity to find, there were all these smart people writing about the music by then, and Rolling Stone and Cream especially, as well as just people I knew. They were using a lot of schmoes in the music section for the most part. I mean, there were definitely exceptions, starting with Gary Giddens, the greatest jazz critic who ever lived. But Patrick Carr, Jeffrey Stokes, a few other people I don't want to dismiss here, who I inherited. I saw that the chance was to do so much more, beginning by covering black popular music. The first section I edited was about the Jackson Five at Madison Square Garden by Vince Aletti, later became the great disco doyen and now writes about photography mostly for the New Yorker. I was always, one of the things that always offended me about rock criticism in the 60s is how it ignored soul music, as it was then called. And that was part of my program with myself from the very beginning, although it wasn't as easy as I thought it was going to be, but I did learn to do it. As soon as I got to The Voice, I looked for people who could do that as well and did what I could to emphasize it in that audience context.
And that's one of the classic examples to me of a fight where you were basically paddling against the tide. There's this, you know, desegregation of music throughout, you know, from the late 40s all the way to the mid 60s, and then it quickly resegregated, you know, the difference between the Tammy Show and Monterey, and then the even bigger racial divide.
Yeah, well, I wrote a piece about the Monterey Pop Festival for Esquire, that I deliberately led with Otis Redding, one of the few black artists to be featured there. The way I would historicize it is to say that for what, when as long as it was AM radio, where that was the main source, which through 68, it basically was. There was plenty of integration. But then so-called progressive radio started, and all of a sudden, all the black hits were let up because that was too pop. It wasn't rock. Rock had a, by that time, that notion had a weight to it, and a weight it deserved sometimes. But it wasn't the only good thing that was happening in popular music. Plus, it was at that very moment that James Brown was completely transforming popular music. I mean, you know, I love Chuck Berry and I love the Beatles. I probably like them more than I like James Brown. But who is the most important musician in this tradition? Without any question, James Brown. Without any question. Completely reorganized the ears of America.
Yeah.
And for just that reason, white America had a lot of trouble hearing what he was doing. It all sounded the same to them. It sounded the same to me too. Took me a while to learn to hear that. And it was partly due to the fact that I had, even in the mid 70s before Nelson George and Greg Tate, and Carol Cooper, surfaced at the Voice, that they were the stalwarts of the black music coverage of the African American who wrote about it anyway. But there was a guy named Pablo Guzman who had been in the Young Lords, and he was an ambitious guy, and he would come up and just jaw. He was the person who made me go back and listen to Brown plus George Clinton, who a few visionary white critics on the West Coast really heard early. And I had to catch up with him as well.
And that's one thing I really appreciate about reading your oeuvre is the way you adjust on the fly. And yet you leave your opinions there. I like, you know, in the introduction, I think, Is It Still Good to You, you talk about how you change things you make corrections to correct matters of fact, but you do not change your opinions. And so things like...
I mean, insofar as I'm wrong, and it happens occasionally, and of course what wrong means is not wrong about some absolute aesthetic. Although, I mean, in certain cases I would make an argument of that sort. Well, my only job is to explain why I like something that I like as a smart person who really knows a lot about music and has heard a lot of music, and to explain why it is I actually like it. That's what I've always... And that's what I, as an editor, I was the editor, music editor of The Voice from 74 to the end of 84. And that's what I always try to tell writers. When I taught writing, I told them the same thing. When people like you would come up and say, what do? I say, first, just find out what you really like, and then figure out why you really like it, and try to put it in an entertaining and intelligent and concise way. That's the job, as far as I'm concerned.
And that allowed you the freedom to then modify your statements as your opinions changed. You know, right from the beginning, you were pretty brutal on Jimi Hendrix in that Monterey review, Psychedelic Uncle Tom.
I still think that was a shit performance. I think that to this day. I have watched it. I have listened to it because so many people think it was a shit musical performance. What I did not understand, and what I fully understand having devoted as much attention to it to do, because initially I call him a psychedelic Uncle Tom, which I, you know, that's not like I said that, so it's in my work. But what I didn't understand at all was how he was playing that all white crowd that in a way that he was sure would attract their attention. He was sensationalizing himself in a way that would make him a star faster. And I still don't think he played very well that night. And I've listened a lot.
And that's a fair assessment. But, and I just want to sneak one point
sure.
in there. And I think you're getting exactly onto it, because his song selection on that, you know, night with the Dylan covers and stuff and songs, Wild Thing and Hey Joe, songs that the crowd would be familiar with. But it also ended up being the trap that Hendrix ended up suffering from and trying to escape. I mean,
that's correct. You know, exactly right. And I wouldn't be surprised if the difficulty of escaping it and his horrible manager was Mike Jeffrey, right?
Yeah.
I'm getting confused. Could very well be the reason he died so young and so unnecessarily. I think he was very depressed and frustrated about it. That, and I've read biographies. I mean, that certainly is the indication, although it was also just a horrible accident, you know.
Yeah.
Not a suicide. It was somebody who did too many drugs and vomited in the wrong way. But
and,
still.
And didn't have people who knew what they were doing to take care of him.
That's right. That's right. But yes, and you know, I also, as it happened, I mean, I think I like that first record, although not as much as I do now. The second record I continue to think is not a terribly good record, but Electric Ladyland, and that was only 2 years later. I mean, that was a motherfucker. And I have a lot of, I listened to a lot of jazz in college, and although I have I don't have the formal chops to be able to describe what I hear, I do hear it. And I know, and so I understood by the time of Electric Ladyland how remarkable his improvisations were in a world where there were an enormous number of improvisations that weren't remarkable at all, where that was considered sort of the ne plus ultra of, that's what being progressive was about. That's what FM radio thought it was doing. It was, you know, giving respect to all of those bad Steve Sill solos.
yes.
He did one of the first jam records with Cooper and one of the
Bloomfield.
First,
yeah, Michael Bloomfield.
Yeah, right, Super right.
Session.
Yeah, Bloomfield was better. But in addition, you know, they just went in there and jammed. They didn't really conceive it at all. Those were pretty good players. And Bloomfield was a great player. I think Stills not became better, of course.
Yeah, and the Stills
not without talent, just Steve Stills, but
yeah, the Stills side
not the giant he said to be.
More song oriented. But I want
right.
to play our next song real quick, and this is one that you introduced me to. This is Problem Solver by Lil Wayne.
My nigga. Yeah, that boy so red. That he didn't count no more problems, I'm the problem solver. He didn't count no more problems, I'm the problem solver. He didn't count no more problems, I'm the problem solver. Click, click, pow, problem solved. He didn't count no more problems.
That was Lil Wayne's Problem Solver, which is pretty jarring contrast from what we're talking about, but I wanted to put it in there because that to me is a perfect example of somebody that I've been peripherally aware of. I mean, I'm a Gen Xer. I was into the second wave of hip hop from Run DMC all the way through the Tribe Called Quest era, dropped out for the gangster stuff. And I'd heard the name Lil Wayne and everything, but it's not until I had the chance to follow, you know, you're a great guidepost to Lil Wayne, because this is somebody who's literally dumping hundreds of songs out on the internet at one point.
Well, that period was one of the most remarkable outflows of creativity in the whole history of this music, as far as I'm concerned. Before then, he had his limitations. Recently, he's been repeating himself and hasn't been so great. But when that mixtape era, and they were culminating in the Carter Three, which a record I think I gave an A- to at the beginning, because sometimes you just have to come in there, you know. It's very hard. One thing I learned as an editor is assigning the follow up to a great album is a very, very perilous thing to do. It is very hard to write a review on deadline of the follow-up to a great album. You just don't have the time to acclimate yourself to what it is, and it is just about impossible to extricate it from what it had just been, what this artist had just been. And so in the case of the Carter Three, I couldn't do it. I mean, I did allow myself a certain amount of leeway doing that kind of work. I tried not to jump the gun on things, and occasionally I mean, I My last expert witness, I wrote about this new Mekons album. The Mekons are a band I adore. I kept trying to love that record. I still don't. I think it's good, but it's not as what they're capable of. Well, this was the same sort of thing. And now, I mean, now I've come to regard the Carter Three as his masterpiece. It's like, it takes everything that he'd been doing on the mixtapes only and shapes it better. It's a really remarkable piece of work.
And that to me epitomizes something they openly have struggled with throughout your work as a critic, is that to really understand great music, even great popular music, it takes some time, and you need to let it soak in. And if you're doing reviews on a deadline, it's, you know, while the market is hot for the new product, that's very difficult. And that's basically an impossible contradiction, and you acknowledge that and just muddle through anyway. So
right. At Rolling Stone, when the various kinds of bootlegging and they're going to steal our music if we let them have it, there was a thing that happened. I guess it probably still happens sometimes, where the journalists would be allowed to go listen to the record, maybe even listen to it twice, and take notes, but could not walk out with the music, and they had to do the review from that. And because everything is deadline oriented, I mean, everything is what's hot, what's new in magazine journalism. And even that's even truer, really, in online journalism. It means that a lot of really inadequate stuff gets written about that music. I mean, so to the extent where there in some online places, they do isn't it called first takes, where they essentially listen to the record and take notes and they print that without claiming that it's the final thing. That's actually a more honest way of doing it than what I just described, where I'm not going to name any names, but the honchos at Rolling Stone, where I had a gig there for about a year and a half after The Voice was purchased by the Hounds of Phoenix and I got fired.
And that was in 2006, right?
That's right. Yeah. All right. Well, this would have been 2006, 2007. I just, you know, I was very well paid at Rolling Stone. I wrote what they, you know, they said you have to review this R. Kelly album, and I figured out ways to really insult the motherfucker, because my attitude was never review him again after I saw that tape online in 2004. It was my job, so I did it, and I managed to hit him pretty hard while I did, without cheating the music. In any case, I would not do that. I would not go in to the studio and take notes and write the review. I just said no. And I respect.
Yeah, and another pitfall of that I think I respect you a lot for avoiding was the Rolling Stone and some really good critics, like Dave Marsh for one, would have sort of an aesthetic agenda, you know, and he for a while was pushing Heartland Rock. And I remember as a young punk rocker being who was also obsessively fascinated with the Rock and Rolling Stone record guide in 83. You know, I love Dave Marsh and I'm letting him build my musical taste, but then I'd read him make this unflattering comparison between, say, Graham Parker and Iggy Pop. And to me, there was no comparison between, you know, the god of punk, Iggy Pop, and Graham Parker, who's some fuzzy duddy old dude. So I admire that.
That's not really fair either. Graham Parker was really good there he started repeating himself much too early, but
sure.
His spiritual limitations really began. Well, it's not like Iggy Pop has no spiritual limitations.
For sure.
And in fact, I don't think Iggy Pop has done a whole lot of great music since 1980 either.
No. And most people, I've always sort of just judged people on their initial explosion, and if somebody manages to be creative over the long term, like Muddy Waters or Neil Young, that's just gravy. But I want to talk a little bit about the role of the critic in creating a canon. And, you know, an introduction, Is It Still Good to You, you kind of run through what you call the titans of rock, which are, you know, pretty conventional choices, but solid ones and well-reasoned, and most of them you've talked about. But there's one that you omit, and you apologize for it. And most of the ones you admitted in previous collections you've gotten to. But I've become really fascinated with the great Louis Jordan. And so I'd like to get you to talk a little bit about
Louis Jordan is certainly in my pantheon.
Oh, absolutely. You just haven't written about him. So I want to get you a little teaser of what you would say about Louis Jordan when you do write a piece about him.
On the one hand, Louis Jordan was the great precursor of what became rock and roll, the 40s precursor. He was a hit maker, enormous in the black community, but with pop crossovers. He was comic. He also played the saxophone, so there was certain jazziness to what he did, but it was definitely not virtuoso saxophone. He was seldom soulful. He was more of a humorist than anything else. And I would say, and when I looked into Louis Jordan, you don't have to look in very hard. His father was a professional musician who worked with a minstrel show. Did he work in blackface? I don't recall. Many, many African-American performers did work in blackface in the 20th century. Supposedly, blackface minstrelsy ends in the end of the 19th century. That's complete ooey. And I don't think people believe it anymore. Used to, though. So all of which is just to say that his father was an entertainer who, it could be claimed, burlesqued the black experience. But the fact of the matter was, the reason minstrelsy survived into the 20th century is not because white audiences liked it. It was because, not primarily, it's not as if there weren't some, but because black audiences liked it. So he was burlesquing the black experience for black audiences. And I think all of that enters into what Louis Jordan achieved. And at some point, I may try to write about exactly how I think that plays out. It's complicated.
I would love to read that, because the sort of popular eclipse of Louis Jordan is something that's fascinating to me, having come to his music pretty late and been blown away then by the scope and accomplishment of it, and also realizing how monumentally popular he was in the 40s.
Everything I've said is about his complexity, not about his success or failure.
Yeah.
He was great. Of that, there is no fucking doubt. He was great. The exact lineaments of that greatness, its complications, that's what's hard to pin down. And my guess is that one reason people don't write about it is that they're scared of it. They really don't approve. I think a lot of them really don't approve, and that's fucked.
Yeah, because he was funny
soulful though, right? Right.
He wasn't, I agree.
I mean, there were other black artists with pop crossover, into especially two different groups, the Ink Spots and the Mills Brothers. They were also people who had black artists who had popular success in the 40s, as was Nat King Cole, yet another example of who I write about in my Harvard collection, Growing Up All Wrong. But the Mills Brothers and the Ink Spots were soulful in very different ways, and made enduring music, even though I'm reminding myself that I probably haven't heard the Mills Brothers in a couple of years, but they were really good.
Yeah.
And plus, of course, there are all kinds of individual exceptions. But as people with bodies of work, those are people with bodies of work that compare not quite as large, to Louis Jordan's.
Yeah. And I was just sort of fascinated by looking at Facebook and what artists have Facebook groups. And, you know, Robert Johnson, for example, has literally a million Facebook followers or likes. And Louis Jordan has less than 300, I think, the best group
really?
I could find. Less than 1,000, definitely. And so
really?
Really? Oh,
I mean, the Robert Johnson stuff thing doesn't, you know, are you familiar with Elijah Wall's book
about Robert
Johnson?
Of course, yeah. I've interviewed him.
Because one of the things Elijah Wall writes about is that far from being the devil propitiating, let's call it, a tortured soul that people often talk about him as being, that a lot of the reasons he was such a big deal was that he lifted pop tricks from the Chicago jump. What was the name of the genre called? I also don't remember the name of the label. There was one big
Bluebird,
big label guy.
Thinking of the Bluebird gang in
Chicago. Bluebird, exactly. Of that world. He robbed those guys. And made it much. I mean, as far as I've never written about Robert Johnson because I found myself so intimidated by the fact that I don't feel his spiritual depth the way I'm expected to. And when I read Elijah, and I put him on recently, and I realized, and I can suddenly hear what Elijah was talking about, and that in addition to all of that stuff, which I'm perfectly ready to concede is probably there, even if it doesn't move me. He cared a lot about melody and clarity and stuff that other blues people who are very admirable in their own ways, say Skip James, did not.
And so let's throw in a Louis Jordan song real quick. This is my favorite Louis Jordan song, Saturday Night Fish Fry.
Now, if you ever been down to New Orleans, then you can understand just what I mean. Now, all through the week, it's quiet as a mouse, but on Saturday night, they go from house to house. You don't have to pay the usual admission if you're a cook or a waiter or a good musician. So if you happen to be just passing by, stop in at the Saturday Night Fish Fry.
It was rocking.
That was a great Louis Jordan Saturday Night Fish Fry. And I'm glad you brought up Elijah Wald because we had him on the show. That was, to me, a really revelatory book. Revisionist, but still appreciating Robert Johnson.
Yeah, he wrote that stupid book about the Beatles. Don't ever forget that. I mean, I love Elijah a lot, but I hate that book.
I actually liked that book a lot. And I don't think it was about the Beatles. I talked about that show. It was more about Paul Whiteman and the history of pop synthesis. But that's
have you listened to Paul Whiteman?
Oh yeah, I've been reading Giddens' Bing Crosby book and really diving into Paul Whiteman.
That's a different matter. That's a different matter.
Sure,
Bing Crosby's a different matter than Paul Whiteman.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm sorry, Elijah. Paul Whiteman isn't any fun anymore.
Well, I don't think he was making that case at all. I think he was just talking about the way music synthesized. But that's neither here nor there. I want to talk about your books. Well, I've got you, and it would be fun to have you on with Elijah sometime, and have a little throwdown there. But one of the the canon creation is one role, and then the political is another. You know, your book reports, you focus on bohemianism and politics. And I think we covered the race politics a little bit. And to me, you know, you were battling the resegregation of music, which wasn't just coming from FM radio. I've talked to people that worked at Rolling Stone in that period.
They did have their tokens, but they were not good about it.
No, and essentially the argument was, well, we put a black guy on the cover and it sold a third as many as when we did, you know, put John Lennon on the cover. And so it was a marketplace decision. And I can understand that, but I don't admire it. And the fact that you kept beating the drum for black music, and as it evolved, you know, black artists were a little slow to pick up on the album format. You know, it wasn't until...
Right, that's right. And that had to do with the economics of their target market, which was not an album buying market.
And you know, and it takes Marvin Gaye rebelling against the Motown system to produce What's Going On, and then Stevie Wonder's Off and Running and everything. But I think ultimately, from the post hip hop perspective, you've been vindicated on that utterly. And the James.
Well, I didn't need to be vindicated, frankly, but thank you. I'm glad.
One
reason I was very early on hip hop. And the reason for that is simple. It's that Pablo Guzman and Joe McEwen and a few other people had really convinced me to immerse in James Brown until I got it. And I'd gotten it. And the reason I think James Brown is the most important musician in this entire tradition is that, as Jonathan Lethem says in his great profile of Brown that appeared about 6 months before Brown died in Rolling Stone, signed by none other than my old friend and former voice music editor Joe Levy, he changed the way everybody in America heard rhythm. They don't know it, but he changed it anyway. And as important as the, what I like to call the foregrounding of the beat in 50s rock and roll music, and the reason it was called the big beat, etc. As important as that was, it was James Brown who then, in the famous things, said every instrument is a drum. And people started to make music as if that was the case. And I know people like Greg Tate, the great critic who started working at The Voice in 81, black critic. He said that he believes that the Ramones were part of that too. Even though the Ramones, attitude towards rhythm was in some ways diametrically opposite to what James Brown was, because they too had a different groove. They changed the groove of the music.
Yeah,
Tommy Ramone turns out to be one of the most important musicians in the history of the music, and like Maureen Tucker before him, but better, teaches himself to play drums, can only do so much, but does it with such ferocity and dedication that when he's replaced by a much more accomplished drummer named Marky, who becomes Marky Ramone, Mark Bell, Marky Ramone has said that it took him months to learn how to play nothing but eighths. It took him months. It was really hard.
And they're doing it in a context in which each instrument...
And it required a lot of physical endurance, too.
I'm sure. And they're doing it in a context where each instrument is basically playing part of a drum or part of the rhythm, like so that the net effect of the Ramones is one drum kit.
I know.
Yeah, which is fascinating.
Band. Holy shit, were they great.
And I want to do one last thing. You start the book reports off with a sort of, I'm not sure, was it New York Review of Books? It's a New York Review of Books style piece called In Search of Jim Crow. It was a Los Angeles.
That's right. It was No. It appeared in The Believer.
Ah, that's right. Yeah. And
I was assigned to do it by a magazine that Henry had called, I think it's called Transition. Henry Louis Gates at a certain point was. He sort of called me up and suckered me in. How can you say no to Henry Louis Gates? But then when I'd written about two-thirds of it, I gave it to a substitute, and I was told, well, we're not paying you, but you can say whatever you want. I wrote the first two-thirds of the piece, I handed it in, and I couldn't say that. I wasn't supposedly that they didn't like my attitude. It was that no one would know what I was talking about. I had to explain what this was. I had to explain what that was. I just told them to go fuck themselves. Finished it, and eventually The Believer published it.
And it's basically a roundup of about half a dozen or so, maybe more than that, probably a full dozen of all the books you mentioned, of various pieces about blackface minstrelsy in the role and evolution of American music. And it seemed like there was sort of a boom in that from the mid-90s through the mid-noughts, where there was a lot of people taking...
There were a bunch of people writing books about it. That's correct. I can't remember the exact number of books I dealt with. I guess it was 8 or 10, probably. 4 or 5 of which were really crucial. I got interested when I got interested in Emmett Miller, who was the guy who did the version of Singing the Blues that Hank Williams ripped off.
Love Sick Blues, yeah.
To his eternal credit, don't get me wrong. It's a great version of Singing
the
Blues. It's not Singing the Blues, I don't mean that. No,
it's Love Sick Blues.
Love Sick Blues, right. Singing the Blues is Guy Mitchell, a forgotten great record. You know that record? Great record.
I do know that record, yeah.
I wrote this piece that's also in my Harvard Anthology, Grown Up All Wrong, about what I heard in this blackface performer, who was a remarkable singer and performer, and that sort of got me started really thinking about this stuff. at that point, there was just one book that anyone knew about by Robert Toll, which I'd been hearing about for years, but had never read. And I started there and then I branched out. I guess I read about 15 books altogether to write that piece.
Yeah, and it's an excellent piece, and kind of comes around ending.
I've had a lot of academics, including Black academics, who tell me they teach that piece. I'm proud of that.
You should be. It's an excellent piece, and this has been an excellent hour talking to Robert Christgau, the Dean of American Rock Critics, about his two new collections, Book Reports, A Music Critic on His First Love, which was reading, and Is It Still Good to You? 50 Years of Rock Criticism, 1967 to 2017. Robert, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It was great. Thank you.
Be sure and subscribe to the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Podomatic, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Let It Rollcast. This episode wraps up our fifth season. We'll be taking a two-week break and then returning with author Ted Gioia on the birth and death of the cool. Is It Still Good to You? 50 Years of Rock Criticism, 1967 to 2017, and Book Reports, A Music Critic on His First Love, which was reading, are published by Duke University Press. Please support our show by ordering via the Amazon referral link on our website, letitrollpodcast.com.
Time for a tempting snack.
Are you sick and tired of movie review shows that are just missing something? Do you need more history? Do you need more laughs? Do you need more meandering, insane ramblings than most movie shows provide? Well, then I've got the show for you. Real Rock, with me, the Rock and Roll Reverend Andy King. On Real Rock, we look to dissect rock and roll movies from not only a historical view, but also through a critical and oftentimes personal view. Every episode of Real Rock is a little different, with occasional parodies, sometimes special guests, and a lot of unhinged rants. So pass the popcorn, pass the vape, and hit the lights. We're going to the movies. Listen to Real Rock wherever you catch your pods.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.